from the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media. It's a live edition of the Digital Campus Podcast. Applause signs are lit, and we're excited to have a great and very large and intimidating audience with us here today for the 70th edition of the Digital Campus Podcast, this week brought to you by GradHacker. GradHacker, a new website featuring advice on hacking graduate life at gradhacker.org and on Twitter at GradHacker, GradHacker, for all your grad hacking needs. Is that good? Did I get the good ad in there? Okay, check's in the mail. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dan Cohen, for those who don't know me. And I'm here with the regulars, Amanda French, to my right.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, Amanda. Tom Scheinfeld.
Hi, everybody.
And Mills Kelly.
Welcome.
So we've never had a live audience. How many people actually listen to this podcast on a regular basis? Okay, great. It's wonderful to actually see our audience. We're excited to get started here. We are taking, for people watching on Ustream, we are still taking requests for what we're going to talk about. If you just send us a reply or a mention on Twitter, we will be sure to get it, and I'll do my best to work it into conversation at Digital Campus. So we're going to start today with a discussion of the Georgia State case. If I remember correctly, it's Cambridge, Oxford, and Sage Presses have sued Georgia State University to get redress for offenses made by the university in terms of copyright law. It could have an enormous impact. It's something that I think our audience should follow very carefully, because it basically involves what they can do in terms of digital course reserves and whether we'll be able to assign more than 1,000 words of any article from now on, or 1,000 books. Mills, have you been following this and know something more than I do about it?
I've been following this one, and I think it's just, I think it's going to be one of those moments that we look back at later and say, oh yeah, that's when all the wheels came off, because the essence of the lawsuit is that that anyone putting readings, copyrighted material, on an e-reserve will be, if the presses are successful, will be limited to 1,000 words. And you know, every university has its own fair use policy, and every university has its own approach to e-reserves. You know, here at George Mason, they won't let you put the whole book on e-reserve. That would be certainly excessive. Instead, though, you know, a chapter out of a book or something like that is pretty common. And this is clearly only for educational use. The library keeps it behind a password, only for the students in that class. And so it's clearly very limited.
Is it 1,000 words without paying permission fees?
It's 1,000 words without paying permission fees.
So you could pay permission to put a whole chapter up, or whatever.
You could definitely pay permission. And so for me, the reason I think this is a really important case, sort of looking forward, is that I think, and why I think the wheels are going to start coming off if the presses are successful, is that if they are, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to stop assigning work from those presses. I mean, when was the last time Oxford University Press published a scholarly monograph, as opposed to something destined for classroom use, but a scholarly monograph for under $45 or $50? And it's been a long time. And so I'm very conscious of how much money my students have to spend for the university and for housing, and in addition to that, for all the all the readings that we assign. And so I try to assign things that keep them that keep them focused on the really important issues in the scholarship, but at the same time, it's some kind of a reasonable cost. So I'm always balancing between the books I require them to buy and the material that I put on e-reserve. Well, I'm just going to stop putting things from these presses on e-reserve and from everybody if it's 1,000 words, because that's not helpful to me. So instead, what am I going to do? I'm going to find the things that are copyright clear. I'm going to find the things that are in, some kind of open access form. And so for me, what's going to happen is the presses are going to, they're killing themselves in doing this. And I think it's a complete misunderstanding of the business model for their business going forward.
I mean, that's my take on all of this, is this just shows, I think this is some of the best evidence we've had of just how broken the university press model is. I mean, get this, the University of Oxford and the University of Cambridge are suing Georgia State University because students and faculty at Georgia State University want to read stuff produced by the University of Oxford and Cambridge. I mean, isn't that the point of those presses? I mean, isn't the point of those universities to disseminate knowledge, to enrich education? I mean, why do they exist then? If that's not what they're there for, I think they just need to go away. I mean, they need to get out of the way.
And I think that this is the outgrowth, too, of university presses having been treated as independent units, right? University presses now are functioning like trade presses. They are supposed to make money, right? And so in order to do that, they get as paranoid as any for-profit organization about recovering their costs and making money.
It was kind of sad to see the Chronicle had a good forum in which they asked several people to write in and talk about, you know, their feelings about this case. And I thought that the saddest one was the university press folks trying to defend the fact that they're reselling back to faculty stuff they've gotten for free. All the, you know, peer review has been done for it for free. They're selling it back, and they're trying to sort of justify this in a moral way. And I was at this meeting yesterday. I think I tweeted this line from someone who was there, who was saying that hell hath no fury like a vested interest masquerading as a moral principle. And I thought that was such a great explanation for this comment of sort of somehow this is, a moral thing that we're keeping scholarly publishing alive, and, you know, if we didn't do this, then all hell would break loose. And I think particularly in this age, in a digital age where we've got these alternatives in terms of open access, open publishing, that, it's not like there can't be forms of publication that are alternatives. The question I have, and I'd be interested to hear from the audience too, is whether this will hasten, as Kevin Smith from Duke said in that forum, hasten the acceleration of open access publishing. And I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, my realist side says probably not. You know, I mean, we've been talking about this on the podcast for 4 years, and there's just a system in place where the incentives are to publish in these more gated forums because they have the brands, et cetera. I don't know how others feel about this.
I agree with you that it probably will not hasten open access publishing. Well, number one, I don't think the publishers are going to get what they asked for. I mean, I just don't think that's going to go through.
What's amazing is that there's no
faculty. It might hasten open access, but I don't think it's going to.
I think in this room are 50% of the scholars in the United States who even know or care about this case.
Right.
Yeah, probably.
Right? I mean, when we talk to our colleagues in the department, they haven't heard about this. They couldn't care. And that yet this, you know, potentially catastrophic event could occur, in which what's even more comical is this 1,000-word limit comes from these legal debates in the 70s, basically around fair use, that were tossed out, that were written into law in the late 70s, as they were not included. They left the standards vague. George is about to explode over here, so we're going to go.
If I could just say one thing about sort of traditional faculty, I think they will, if this lawsuit is successful, they will become quickly aware of the problems with this, because there's on every campus there's going to be some entity that's going to be checking their syllabi to make sure they're not assigning anything that violates these guidelines. And so when you try to assign a book chapter and you're told you can't, you'll know.
Well, and then just people are going to make end runs around it anyway. I mean, a lot of us run our course websites off campus. I think increasingly there's a commercialization or a consumerization of technology on the campus, where we're using Amazon Web Services and WordPress and all these places, and stuff will just leach out around the system. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
I actually think that it's going to accelerate open publishing because, first of all, as we all know, it's getting harder and harder and harder to publish that first monograph anyway, and so there's been a push, especially from younger scholars, to get some other system than this gated process that we all had to live with. But secondly, I think we'll see the acceleration is in the second book. I think that people will still continue for a while anyway to publish with the major university presses because their tenure requirements say they need some kind of branding. But then there's no incentive after that. There's absolutely no incentive after the first book. And so I think that's where the presses are going to see the real loss initially, is that people are going to stop publishing their second books like that, because it's just too easy to do it another way. And, you know, the first book, there, you know, you wrote your dissertation, you did all this work, you want to get that job, you want to get tenure, you have all these clear incentives. After that, there's just not the clear incentive anymore. And so the real purpose of further books after the first one is to circulate knowledge as rapidly as possible to as many people who will benefit from it and engage in a conversation with you. And you can do that in an open way, where you can't do it if it's 1,000 words at a time.
I mean, and I'd like to point out too that, you know, when we're talking about e-reserves, I was working in e-reserves at Emory, just down the road from Georgia State University, when this case first broke, when it was, you know, first sued. And Emory had just put into place a policy of being really careful about e-reserves. So they set aside $25,000 in the budget, and I think that they had to up it after that to pay to the Copyright Clearance Center. I mean, essentially it was like, well, we've been doing all this and we haven't been paying anything, and now we're going to start paying $25,000 a year, at least, for stuff that we've been doing already. I did some statistics about who was using e-reserves, and let's be clear, e-reserves means stuff that's already owned by that university library. All right, get your mind around that for a minute. You know, okay, so the university's library has already paid for a print copy of this book or whatever. Several faculty want to have a chapter or different chapters from that put up online in a central place, and our library did that as a service. As you say, lots of people do it differently. So only 30 or 40% of faculty were using e-reserves. I'm certain that a whole bunch of other faculty were making PDFs of stuff and putting them up on Blackboard, which had nothing to do with e-reserves at all. And we were talking about, well, can we build software that will make everybody have to go through our e-reserve system in order to, so that we can build in some copyright checking, you know, before Blackboard. I mean, it was just like a technical problem that was too hard to solve. But actually, when the Georgia State case broke, it was kind of like, phew, it's a good thing we set aside this 25K, because, you know, we had been doing more or less what they were doing.
Well, and I think the example of Emory and Georgia State is a really good one, because let's say that the suit is successful. Well, Emory can then afford to pay this. Georgia State cannot.
Yeah.
And so what another implication of this is that the elite universities are going to be able to pay these kinds of fees. And in that forum, one of the examples was a course pack from a government class in Harvard. The course pack cost $450. And, okay, Harvard could help their students in some way, if necessary, with that. But, the Georgia State, George Mason, the sort of mass market universities around the country cannot. And so then you have a situation where students attending elite universities have access to material, students attending non-elite universities don't. And that's a huge problem.
Okay, have we beaten the horse dead yet? We'll move on. No.
I mean, my vibrations started in about 1997, when Ed Fox started the electronic thesis and dissertation program at Virginia Tech University. And they thought that they had a way of allowing students who had non-traditional media, meaning not just paper and pictures, as part of their thesis or dissertations, to create these digital. And what they ran into was not the presses, but they ran into the professional organizations like, you know, the math, the science, you know, the chemistry association, that if they were to do this, it would be viewed as prior publication, and they couldn't even print their first book. Okay. So they've had various boycotts already. And I think you're going to have to get buy-in from a very large community to make this happen.
Right. We're getting a little hate from the Twitter from Ian Bogus. Hi, Ian.
Hi, Ian.
And, you know, he's talking about us
navel-gazing
and viable alternatives. I think it is a good question. And I think maybe, you know, the question is, let's say there is a point of, which will be a point where a lot of PR will happen on both sides. But The question is, at that point, let's say Georgia State loses the case, are there actually viable alternatives, right? And I think we've thought a lot about, actually at several of that camps, about potential viable alternatives for producing high quality scholarship that happen in open access ways, that have sustainable models. We don't have time to get into that here, but I think that's absolutely an irrelevant question. I hope we haven't been staring at our navel too much.
And there is I think there's a session that's been proposed for tomorrow or the next day on
the unpresses.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, there is I do think the criticism is right. Like, if we're, I think what I take from it is that if we're going to complain about this, we need to get out there and start providing those alternatives.
Sure.
I don't think we can let the university presses, the AUP, you know, like, try to do this for us. I think we're going to have to take some initiative.
Right. And I just think it's a great case where, let's say, Georgia State loses the case completely. If there was, let's say, a press like Berkeley Electronic Press, which already exists, has a business model, does open access journals, sells them to libraries on a subscription basis, if they were to say, hey, you can port your whatever journal on Topology from a gated journal, when the contract's up with Cambridge or Oxford or Sage, you can port it over to us, we're going to make it open access, anyone can use it freely, they can appeal to the board, the editorial board of and the scholarly society that supports that journal as an alternative. I think that's a case where, you know, there'll be a moment of, I think, really reckoning for those things, and whether faculty, I think, care enough to perhaps move it to alternative venues.
It's going to be hard for those organizations, though. I mean, the thing is that it's so easy to sign with Oxford, because they're just, you know, they say, we'll take care of it all for you. You know, don't worry about any of this. Like, we'll give you the website, we'll do the whole thing. And, you know, doing something different requires the membership of the organization, the board of the organization, the executive committee, and the executive director of the organization to, you know, put real work and thought and time into how this is going to work. And but I think that's going to have to happen if we end up with results like we're facing here.
Yeah, you know, I think we've also, Chris, do we need to repeat questions from the audience, or are we picking them up?
It
wouldn't hurt.
We picked
up
them, but it wouldn't hurt to.
Yeah, I mean, the question is actually how much these universities' presses do at the end of the day, and they're doing less and less. I mean, it's been a long time since they did things like indexes, and now they don't. If you want to do an author's blog or something like that, a lot of that's on you as well.
Well, it's a vicious circle for them, because they get, I mean, Oxford and Cambridge being perhaps a bit of an exception, but other university presses, they get less money, and so they don't have as many people and can't offer as many services, you know, and that's where the value kind of goes away, but they get less money because I think people are saying, well, everything's on the internet, and, you know, I don't even know why university presses are being defunded to the extent that they are.
I think at the end of the day, it's, I mean, like a lot of these things, it's not a technical question, it's a social, cultural question, and it's a brand question. I mean, I think a lot of this revolves around the power of the brand and the difficulty of overcoming brand, the brand stamp on something like a book, right? And, you know, I think that's the question. Actually, a lot of the really interesting literature is actually from economics on this, of how brands erode over time. But one of the ways brands erode is from PR disasters, like something like the Georgia State case, where people
right.
who were formerly not caring about an issue or didn't realize the system suddenly realize or start learning about the way the university publishing system happens. And I think that's where you start to get into a point where there can be a shift.
And right. I, you know, your earlier comment about vested interests masquerading as moral a moral principle, I'm probably included in that category as well. But my vested interest when I'm teaching a university class is I need to do my job. I mean, I get a kind of moral outrage about this. My job is to share information with these students. They're already paying a huge amount of tuition. I mean, if it's a question of e-reserves, the library already owns that book. You know, I am trying to do my job. I'm trying to share information with the students. That's it. And if you're putting obstacles in my way, I'm going to be angry.
Okay. I think we should move on. Sherman Dorn on Twitter is asking where the devil's advocate is. He's under the table.
I'll even take a little devil's advocate position. One thing that these universities say is that, well, you guys were paying permissions for printed course packs, which is true. I think that, but again, it's a case where the technology makes, you don't have, you know, it's useful for each student to have a printed copy of that article, right? But if you can put it online, well, they can each print that out, right? I mean, there's no technological reason for us to make the printed course packs anymore. I don't know. It's I think that I would actually say too. There's probably not much question that Georgia State professors did infringe, as I understand it. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but it looks like, you know, what they were doing was, you know, okay, yes, it's infringement probably within the legal definition of fair use. But does that definition go far enough? Probably not. And again, it's like this whole ambiguity about what a classroom is, because there's a classroom exception, right? Except these feel like virtual classrooms. Like if you've got a Blackboard or whatever, you know, that feels like your class. Well, it's not actually your classroom. It's a website, which is a publication. And so you're not allowed to republish it. You know, it's just a mess.
Okay. We're still taking topics via Twitter, so if you just add us, I will try to work it in. Someone had a question, actually, I'd forgotten about this, about Google getting out of the newspaper digitization business.
Oh, yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
I have a tiny little thought. Listeners to the podcast will know that I've been following the Digital Public Library of America project very closely. My only tiny point about Google getting out of the digitization business was that a few people on the DPLA listserv were saying, hey, maybe this is something the DPLA can take over, is doing some digitization of newspapers. I don't think that's going to fly, but it was a suggestion.
Well, and the NEH has been funding the digitization.
Yeah, right.
First the microfilming and now the digitization of newspapers for, I don't know, 10, 12 years.
People pointed that out as well. They were like, there are people digitizing newspapers.
My thought is this is the danger of relying on a commercial interest to do this work for us. You know, they decide one day, yeah, not making money for us. Just, you know, we can increase shareholder profits by, you know, dividends by a penny if we get rid of this, and they get rid of it. And so, you know, when we rely on Google to do, you know, to digitize books and to do those kinds of things, you know, we have to know what we're getting into. That these are commercial operations. They have their own interests. They have to do what's right for their shareholders, legally, morally, even. And that's what they're going to do. And those interests aren't always going to be our interests.
The other slightly irrelevant thought I had about that, not having had time to read much in the news lately, is there's a great book by Nicholson Baker called Double Fold, which often, I know we've got people here from the Library of Congress and librarians. It's a slightly anti-library book, but I love it nonetheless. And that book is actually about how... It's about how newspapers need to be digitized on one level. It tells the story of microfilming of newspapers and how libraries were very keen to jump on the microfilming bandwagon, which again was done by private companies. And that because all the newspapers were on microfilm and libraries wanted to save space, many libraries started throwing away newspapers to the point where, whoops, entire runs of obscure newspapers were no longer to be found physically and were only to be found on microfilm, which if you've ever done a lot of microfilm reading, you know, there are errors in the scanning and it's black and white, right? I mean, there were some beautiful color processes even in the 19th century, which people don't even know about. So at any rate, book recommendation, Double Fold.
You know, when I think about Google doing things or not doing things, I actually think not in terms of profits, because they clearly do a lot of things that are not profitable. But I actually think their driving force is, can we get useful data out of a project? I actually think the book scanning project, one of the hidden stories is there's actually a lot of useful data from it. There's useful data for translation, automated translation, for instance, because they will have parallel copies of books that haven't been co-scanned before. Whereas a lot of machine translation used to use just the United Nations transcripts, which are translated, or the Bible, or things like that. So there are reasons to do that. I think there were reasons to do Google 1-800-GOOG-411, their service that they recently stopped, because they had gotten enough voice recordings to be able to do really high quality voice analysis. And I suspect that just newspapers are just uninteresting from a data perspective, but I may be wrong about that.
I bet they're also much harder to, you know, like,
right.
I mean,
right.
Like, when a front page says continued on page A14, you know, column 3, what does a computer do with that? You know, it's very difficult to, it's not just a book that has, that goes all the way through. Probably it's just harder to then put all that information in a database that can be useful and usable by, you know, by a machine.
Right. Okay. Good question. Thank you for that. Schema.org, came out this week. And people can check that out at schema.org. Surprisingly. I repeat myself. Sort of an interesting attempt by three unlikely partners, right? It is Bing/Microsoft, Yahoo, and Google, all trying to, for what seems to me like the umpteenth time, advance some kind of structured data schema for the web so that their search engines can crawl websites and pick up information that is not encoded. I mean, this is a problem we've run into in a lot of ways. For instance, in our Zotero project about bibliographic data being very hard to acquire from web pages because it's not often in structured formats on a web page. There've been a lot of these things around. There's I think microformats.org has been around forever. There have been other things like in bibliographic records, COINS, which is the context object in span tags, which is a way to put in bibliographic information into a span tag in HTML. But this seems like it's got a lot of weight behind it. What do people think of this? I mean, I'm kind of two minds. I mean, when I first saw it come out, whenever I think of standards, I always think of that sort of joking aphorism of, you know, the great thing about standards is there are so many of them. And I couldn't decide whether it was that kind of a thing or whether with these companies behind it, you'd have, let's say, the Yelps of the world, or maybe in our world, the archives of the world, or libraries or museums encoding their web pages with this data so that someone could find a rare coin more easily through a Google search. Any chance of succeeding, or is this something where people just don't encode their pages with semantic information?
Well, I think, I actually think, Dan, it probably speaks to your last point. It depends whether Google sees this as useful machine readable data. You know, I think a lot of things at Google, I think the problem with them is, I mean, I think one of the great things about them is they kind of bubble up from the ground, that they're, you know, 20% time projects. I think it sort of depends whether this is something that, like, Google is really going to buy into, that they use these standards across their properties, across YouTube and Yelp and all of the other content properties that they own. If they, you know, if Google and Microsoft and Yahoo, all of whom own like vast portions of the web, decide to implement this across those properties, then all of a sudden it does, you know, they become standards. Like, it is standard, and the rest of us will follow. But if it's just, you know, something a couple of people at these companies agreed to and think is a good idea, but there's no real, you know, investment behind them, investment in time to change their content properties, then I think it's probably going to go the way of all these other standards.
Well, but it doesn't rest with Google as to whether this is a success or not, really, because it really rests with individual webmasters and whether they're going to use these markup tags, right?
But they're only gonna I guess what I'm saying is, it's true, but they're only gonna lead, I mean, they're only gonna follow if somebody leads, you know. I mean, it's just you know, a million webmasters aren't going to spontaneously, you know, change all their code.
They will if they think it improves the search results.
Well, see, that's maybe. Have these three companies have so much leverage, and that's really about where your site shows up in the algorithm.
Well, and I've been looking at the announcement, and it doesn't actually promise that. Doesn't look like, but I think that's implicit.
Yeah, but
you know?
They've had these sitemaps. Remember,
right.
I mean, Google.
Yeah.
It's probably been 7 years since they came out with sitemaps, which was a really simple XML-based way of essentially putting a file in your root directory for your website. We did it here at the center,
yeah.
for
yeah.
instance, for the 9/11 project, to try to get more of our pages indexed, because we found that we had 150,000 pages, but only I think 10,000 of them were indexed. Willy-nilly.
And I actually think that worked.
I think it did work.
But that's the page,
yeah,
it's not the page
we jumped
content.
Way up in the search
right,
results.
But it's not semantic content. Right, so it's more like, here's an outline of what's on this website. If you're a spider, then here's how to get all of our stuff.
What this would enable...
How many people did that? And then you could register it with Google that you had a sitemap.
I think a lot of people do that, actually.
That?
Like, I think a lot of people do that. I mean, and there are whole companies, you know, that do SEO, and I mean, I have taken a few mild workshops in that, and they always say, you know, create a sitemap and that ups your search ranking and stuff like that.
Mm.
But I mean, like, what this would do, and I was reading a little bit about it, it says it's microdata, which is a balance between the extensibility of RDF and the simplicity of microformats, so it's a kind of a, you know, not quite lightweight format, but so if you mention a person in a page, you can mark that up with, hey, this is a person,
mm.
right? And then if people were searching for that, you know, like it, if the name of the page is the name of the person, right, that's easy enough. But if you just happen to mention a person in a page, this would make that show up
right.
in the search results.
That did seem to be, some of the commentary was, this is an attempt to provide an alternative to privately held identity information, right? Facebook or a Twitter where there's a x.com/AmandaFrench,
mm-hmm.
right, which... Google has itself, right? Google profiles. But where you could have on your own site, AmandaFrench.net or DanCohen.org, you could encode that information so that would be your, in a sense, root identity directory,
mm-hmm.
right? And so some people were sort of speculating that this was an attempt to decentralize, right, away essentially from Facebook in
yeah.
a lot of cases and possibly even Twitter so that you could have information flowing in a more decentralized way. I mean, you know, in some ways it's just like a very engineered solution, and it strikes me, again, to the social cultural questions,
yeah,
that it's going to be hard to do unless, let's say, WordPress.com decides to encode all their pages in that way, or Amazon, or someone with a lot of data and metadata decides to just write it right into
yeah.
the software.
And I think even if they do, I mean, it has the problems, which I think we've talked about before on the podcast. It has, you know, some of the problems that are inherent in markup, in that somebody's got to do the markup, and you know, it's just it requires effort, more effort on the part of the producer of the page, and it's just a question whether that, you know, is that effort going to be worthwhile? Is it going to give? What are you going to get for that
that
investment?
Are we going to go back and remark up all our sites at CHNM? No.
No.
It's just, no. Not gonna happen.
Right. Patrick Murray-John brings up on Twitter that I guess Drupal already encodes things in RDFA, if I can get a verbal confirmation. Is that correct?
Yeah,
and so right. So I think right. So Drupal is a good case of that. WordPress would be a case where if the encoding were to happen at that level. I don't know if people have checked out the actual schema, but you know, it's something.
Well, it's interesting because it has categories like offer. Right, which means
right.
20% off. You're that camp registration
right.
today only. So, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I found the stuff that was at least applicable to academia to be very abstract.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, a book is a thing. I felt like philosophy 101. You know, you first specified like place, earth. You know, type, human creation. You know, entity, book. Right. You know, that it was. It was of that, like, Aristotle's beginning with first principles, and I felt like, boy, that's a lot of work versus, you know, we've seen a lot of people implement coins on their websites because it's sort of like a cheap, dirty hack, which
mm-hmm.
often works because you just literally just stick this big ugly span tag, and it's literally just like author equals Dan Cohen, and just right there in the attributes.
Well, at some point there's going to be a next generation web, right? And I mean, the debate about whether linked data in general or the semantic web in general has a future is ongoing, and that's always the issue. It's too much work, but it adds a lot of value, but it's too much work, but it adds a lot of value, but it's too much work, but it, you know, and it goes on like that.
Right.
So, but at some point, you know, the web we have today is not the web we're going to have forever. I'm certain of that. What we see in 5 or 10 years, whether that's dependent on this kind of thing, rich structured data, that's certainly one direction that the web could go. But maybe it is more like you just get to do everything in text, and there are better search engines or better something else that isn't a search engine that does natural language processing, so that all you have to do is type it in. Or it isn't even text. It's all audio and video, and we've gone into a post-text society, you know. That could be it.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, I had heard yesterday for the first time about this ORCID project, ORCID.org, which I'm going to get the acronym wrong, but it's something like the Open Researchers ID. It's basically just gives, I mean, essentially it's sort of like an authority file, which the Library of Congress already has. If you've published a book, you get basically an ID from the Library of Congress specifying who you are. And interestingly, I sort of potentially heard that the LC might be involved with this ORCID in some way, or could maintain some master file, but it could expand out to, for instance, web publications, other forms of publications, which I think is interesting for this audience. I mean, obviously the main drivers are the sciences, where, you know, there's real intense need to track people's publications, and there's a lot of money around it, and a lot of legal filings that universities have to do to say this is our research and this is not our research. So there's reasons to have it there. But I thought this was kind of an interesting idea, that maybe there'd be responsible organizations or even an independent entity that would maintain authority files or linked data information about different things, about entities. A lot of national libraries already maintain interesting URLs, sort of IDs for things. Library of Congress maintains a really interesting set of IDs for concepts. See, there's actually Plato's Allegory of the Cave is actually, you can go and get an ID for that. And you can use that ID on your blog if you're talking about Plato's Allegory of the Cave, and then connect that up. Theoretically, in a semantic way, you could connect that up to other things. So it may be that maybe there's responsible organizations that kind of maintain these things and make sure. I realize it's not on our list, but there's this, you know, just a related thing, this push to get new bibliographic records and to get beyond the MARC records that have been such a nightmare.
I forgot about that. That is news.
It might be inside baseball, but I saw Deanna Markham of the Library of Congress yesterday, and I think this is actually a big deal also in the same area where they realize they've got this old technology that kind of is from the age of the 3x5 card and the physical card catalog, and that they're trying to find some new way to have high quality bibliographic records that would be shared between Google and the Library of Congress and Internet Archive. I don't know. Is this too random of a topic? Should we move back to other things?
Every librarian I know was all agog, by this, or anybody involved in, you know. So the MARC record is old, because it was so sort of pioneering at the time. It was, you know, a way to mark up a bibliographic object so that it could be shared by computers. But it dates
from the 60s.
And so they, you know, but it's become such a standard, you know, that it's going to be a big pain to replace it. But there are beginning conversations about that.
At the ALA winter in 1991, CNI held a workshop with Sally McCallum and the Library of Congress group. Cliff Lynch was there. Peter Deutsch from Lucky, and then the WACE folks and some of the other IETF folks. And it was an interesting culture clash, because McCallum and LOC wanted to document in MARC records tapes, this is before the web, by IP number. And that would be the permanent address. How many people move their files to different machines?
Everybody.
So we took 2 days to educate the the Library of Congress, and it was a very interesting conversation. Right. If anybody wants to know more.
I'm sure that they've, you know, they're all over that now. You know, I think the Library of Congress is probably, I mean, you know, the MARC record is really the base of all kinds of, you know, it's the base of every library catalog. You know, those are all functioning on MARC records. So, you know, I don't think it's lack of knowledge that has prevented them from moving away from that in the past. It's just that it's an enormous undertaking.
Okay.
I just wanted to say that the ORC ID, you know, the Open Researcher and Contributor ID is going to be important to distinguish, you know, the Amanda French, who's an embezzler and an ignorant Yahoo, from the Amanda French, who is
a serious researcher.
A serious accredited researcher. So I just want
to
say
you that. From the serious researcher.
Hey. Did you see this?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. See, we don't have video, so video helps with tats, right?
We do have video.
No, I know. This is like the first time that, there we go. We'll zoom in on that. Okay, we're going to lightning round. I just made that up. It's a new segment here on the podcast. Lightning round.
Whoa.
Question from the back. Yes.
It wasn't a question, it was a comment.
Oh, please. Yeah, I'm going to repeat the comment because it turns out the mic's having a little trouble picking up from the outside.
I think that's probably because MARC record people go to school for quite a long time to learn how to make MARC records. Talk about, you know, the distinction between structured data is a lot of work, but it adds a lot of value. Librarians are willing to put in that work. I mean, you get trained as a cataloger and you put a lot of information in that records, and it's very, very, very structured. There certainly are glitches, but, you know, on the whole, there's a lot of information there, and it's easily transferred.
Okay. Thanks for the further comments on MARC records. Okay, lightning round. Any quick topics you'd like us to discuss or that you'd like to discuss? Any from people viewing on this camera that's sitting in front of us?
I want to discuss Creative Commons licenses on YouTube. Anybody else?
That's pretty neat.
YouTube just announced?
No, greatest day of my life at Creative Commons on YouTube.
Yeah.
I cannot wait.
Yeah, so Steve Ramsey agrees. Big news. YouTube is finally going to put Creative Commons, allow users to specify Creative Commons licensing for videos that they upload, which is great. Flickr has had this for a while, and this means that YouTube videos, you'll now know whether you're allowed to use them and mix them up and mash them up and so on. You know, heck, even if we're talking about the GSU case earlier, if more scholars even put Creative Commons licenses on their work on the web, that would be useful.
I see. I'm thrilled about it too, but I do see a whole lot of copyrighted content being released by third parties under Creative Commons licenses on YouTube. I mean, you're gonna do a Creative Commons search, and you're gonna find, you know, the Prince video and the Disney movie.
It's funny, I see that on YouTube too. People put up like a clip from some TV show that they clearly don't have the rights to put up. And what they'll do is they'll say in the comments, is like, I'm not trying to infringe on anyone's copyright. I'm not claiming any ownership. And it's like, it's too late. It's infringed, you know. And then I watch it and I go away happy.
I mean, in some sense, I hate to get serious again back in this Georgia State thing, but it's very interesting to see these alternative systems where the default is for sharing, right? And I think when there's currently a flame war going on here in the Twitters about what we said about university presses, but I think it's very interesting to think about systems where, surprisingly, it's lighting up my tweet deck here. But I think it's interesting to look at systems where the default is a Creative Commons license, and then what happens to that material? I mean, how is it used in the classroom? I know, Mills, you use a lot of YouTube videos. You know, I was looking at recently, University of Pennsylvania does a mashup contest every year where they have students mash up video, mostly from YouTube, and this sort of enables that kind of secondary creativity.
Yeah, I mean, it's YouTube is becoming so ubiquitous for teaching purposes that having things available through Creative Commons is going to, I think, facilitate that. I don't think university faculty members are worried about when they're going to show a YouTube video in their classroom. I don't think it even occurs to them to think, I wonder if this is a copyright infringement or not. Instead, they say, oh, look, there's that video of the United Nations General Assembly I need, and they put it up on the screen, and that's going to continue to happen. So I don't think it's going to have a real change in the way we use YouTube in the classroom.
Mm.
So I'm not sure it's like that kind of a big change, not for teaching anyway.
Well, it enables, I'm not sure that people's actual practice will change much as regards YouTube, but it does mean that, you know, for instance, you could do creative works with YouTube now more obviously. I mean, the way YouTube was architected was always really brilliant, because embedding a video means that you don't have to, it doesn't trigger copyright protection. Like, everybody embeds YouTube videos on their site, and that's not the same as copying it, right? So there really is no copying when you want to show. Or you're performing it, right, in a classroom, and that, again, you're not making a copy, so you're not triggering copyright. But what you could do now with a lot of confidence is, YouTube offers downloads now. You could download YouTube videos and mix them up together in some kind of creative format. And you could even do scholarship with that. You could, you know.
Well, Mike Weiss at Kansas State said his students doing that for several years, and you can see some very interesting work that they've done, you know, along the lines of this mashup stuff.
Right.
I mean, and also the fair use issues on this are entirely unenforceable, because if it's on YouTube, who's going to come around and look in every single classroom at George Mason and say, wait, no, you can't be showing that. That's entirely unenforceable. And because of the embedding, as you say, if I embed something on a class blog, it's not violating the fair use. It's just saying, here's this video, and it's on this other website. Go look at it.
I saw recently at last fall at a undergraduate digital humanities conference that I went to at Bryn Mawr in Haverford, I saw a student show a video essay he had done about the television show The Wire, and as someone who has taught film and television in English classes, and you have to write the paper about the film and television, the video essay was a real revelation to me. I was like, wow, if I ever were in a classroom again assigning people to write, interpret, analyze video materials, they should do that in video form. And I happened to hear Michael Wesch speak at the University of Mary Washington recently, and he was enthused about teaching people to edit video as, you know, a basic skill of digital literacy. I mean, I get very enthused about teaching people to publish to the web as a basic skill of digital literacy.
The great thing about Mike's presentations about this is he doesn't teach people how to do that. He just shows them, he shows students video mashups and says, go do that. And they do. And somebody, he was here last year, and somebody said, well, how much time do you spend teaching your students how to do this? And he said, none, I don't know how to do it.
That's not true. He knows how to do it. That's
and
not
so
true.
He said, I just told them to go do it. And he said, well, everything I know how to do, they've showed me how to do. So so it's really, it's not a skill that is that difficult for students who, grew up in this world where these things were always there.
Okay, well, we've got some stomach rumbling on Twitter. Thank you, whoever that was, for your... We do have lunch waiting outside. I want to thank everyone for joining us for this live edition of Digital Campus. And we will discuss some of the other issues that people brought up on Twitter. They want us to have a knife fight over Creative Commons, different kinds of Creative Commons licensing. But you'll have to wait for that for episode 71 of Digital Campus.
Which will be live from Florida. The beach.
That sounds great.
News to me.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. It's great.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country is.